Chapter 24. Without having information about the asteroid base itself, we couldn't plan an assault. We could at least attempt to tackle the problem of how we get to the place in order to launch an assault. So I called together Chotek, Chang, Smythe, Sims, Desai, Adams, and Friedlander. I wanted Chotek there not because I thought he could help, but because I wanted him to see again how difficult it is to develop solutions on the fly. In this case, literally on the fly, as the Flying Dutchman was proceeding back to the relay station at maximum speed. "Skippy," I said to the shiny beer can on the table, "let me know whether I understand the problem." "Enough." He had a soft blue glow when he said that. I had brought him out of his man cave and into the conference room because I get tired of speaking with a disembodied voice sometimes, and because it is good for us to be reminded of what the super-powerful being who runs our stolen starship looks like. Or what he looks like to us, since Skippy frequently reminded me that most of him wasn't in this space-time. Whatever that meant. "Huh? If you understand the problem enough, because there is no way that you could ever fully understand the problem, Joe." "That's fair, I guess. This asteroid is so close to the star, the neutron star," Skippy interrupted with a slow orange glow. Now I was annoyed. "What's the difference? It's a star. Anyway, there is a very major difference, Joe," Skippy said, and I could see Friedlander nodding in agreement. "I shall attempt to explain it to you." "Ugh," I groaned. This was going to be painful for both of us. "Go ahead." "One thing before we get started," Skippy insisted. "What's that?" "Dr. Friedlander owes me a joke." "You're kidding me." "I kid you not, Joe. Whenever I participate in the meetings of the science team, Friedlander always starts the meeting with a joke. Calling that group of monkeys a science team is itself a joke, but I mean a joke with a punchline."
"Sure," Friedlander said with a grin. "How many software engineers does it take to change a light bulb?"
I said, trying to guess.
"None," Friedlander said with a wink. "That's a hardware problem."
"Okay," I laughed. "That is a good tradition."
"Agreed," Skippy said with a chuckle. "Now, to make this short, it is important that you understand the difference between a normal main-sequence star and a neutron star. A neutron star is the collapsed core of a star that was much larger than Earth's sun. When such a star goes supernova, gravity causes the core to collapse to the point where the remnants of the star are compressed almost to the point of becoming a black hole. And yes, shut up over there, Friedlander, I know that I am hugely dumbing this down for Joe's benefit. The point, Joe, is that this particular neutron star is old and cold. Although this core remnant is almost twice the mass of Earth's sun, it is tiny. The asteroid orbits very close to the surface of the star, close enough that the Theranin must be using powerful artificial gravity within the asteroid to compensate for the tidal forces. If this was a hot main-sequence star, an asteroid that close would melt and burn to a crisp. Do you understand?"
"I think so, yes," I said. "And thanks for explaining that to us. It means we do not need to worry about the Dutchman overheating as we approach the asteroid?"
"That is not the lesson I wanted you to learn, Joe, but you are at least partly correct. Most of the star's remaining radiation is in the form of X-rays instead of visible light. Those X-rays disrupt the effectiveness of stealth fields as a ship approaches the star, making it impossible even for us to sneak up on the asteroid undetected. The Theranin Advanced Research Directorate chose this location carefully and wisely. The intense gravity also acts as a lens, bending light around the star. Even if we were on the other side of the star, the asteroid station could see us."
Friedlander couldn't stop from interjecting.
"The asteroid is also orbiting close enough to the star's surface that time dilation is measurable, and must be compensated for..."
"Yes, thank you, Mr. Egghead Rocket Scientist," Skippy said scornfully. "You and I can address that later, Friedlander. Until then, kindly shut up."
"Great," I said. "You two please do that later. We're here to consider how to approach the asteroid for an assault. After the assault, we won't be able to jump away, right?"
"Correct, Joe. I can flatten space-time so that our pirate ship will be able to jump away while we are closer to the star than a typical ship could, but we still will need to travel a considerable distance through normal space before we reach jump altitude. During that time, we will be vulnerable to pursuing vessels. Although we do not have data on this particular station, I expect it to be protected by at least one destroyer-size ARD warship. Jumping away is not the main problem, Joe."
"Yeah, I know," I said glumly. This was sounding more and more impossible. We need to get inside the station first and defeat their defenses.
No, you dum-dum. Skippy glowed a soft purple.
Damn, you do not listen when I talk, do you? Not only can we not jump away, we can't jump in anywhere near that asteroid. We have to jump in far away and travel through normal space to reach the asteroid, while our stealth field degrades. We will not have any advantage of surprise.
Oh, I said, surprised. I did hear when you said that, but I figured you could do some magical flattening space-time thing so we could jump in closer than most ships could.
No, you dimwit, I can't do that.
Mr. Skippy, Chang interrupted. We watched you make a hole in a star. After that, you were able to flatten space-time so we could jump away very close to a star. I realized that was not a neutron star, but...
But nothing, Skippy said scornfully. That was totally different. I can flatten space-time close to where I am, on the near end of a wormhole. That helps us jump out. I can't flatten space-time at the far end of a wormhole because we aren't there yet, duh!
So that little trick does not help us jump into an intense gravity well. The gravitational field of a neutron star would distort the far end of our jump wormhole so that it would collapse on itself. Even if we managed to stabilize it somehow and go through, the stresses at the event horizon on the far end would tear the ship apart as soon as we emerged.
I slumped back in my chair. Damn. So we can't take the Dutchman in? Before Skippy could answer, Chotek spoke.
We will not risk the ship in this operation. Risking the ship risks our ability to perform our primary mission. While I sympathize with the force on Paradise, their security is not our primary objective. Whatever plan your team develops, Colonel Bishop, it cannot involve placing this ship at risk.
Crap. I exchanged a look with Chang. He was thinking the same thing I was. Maybe there was a level of risk Chotek would accept if we could convince him the risk was manageable and worth the result.
That would come later. We needed a workable plan before we try selling it to Chotek.
Dropships, then. We take a team there in dropships.
Friedlander was shaking his head even before Skippy spoke.
No go on that either, Joe, Skippy said. It would be far too dangerous to the team in the dropships. The dropships do not have artificial gravity. As they approach the asteroid, tidal forces would tear the crew apart inside the hulls. The ARD uses specialized ships to service this station. Even if we were able to take the Flying Dutchman in, our ability to maneuver as we approached the star would be substantially restricted. Tidal forces on the forward hull and the aft engineering section would cause the ship's spine to separate.
Crap, Skippy, I protested.
This is no good at all.
As I said, Joe, the location of this asteroid base provides very effective security without the Theranin having to do anything. Ships can't use their full stealth ability on approach, and they can't engage in typically violent combat maneuvers. The Theranin can sit safely in their asteroid and lob railgun darts and missiles at enemy ships that aren't able to dodge out of the way.
This was sounding like a truly impossible mission. Maybe I needed to go back to the beginning and think of a new way to rescue our forces on Paradise.
We can't take the ship in, Chang nodded toward Chotek, and we can't send an assault team in dropships. This asteroid station is not self-reliant. It requires resupply regularly.
Ships do visit the station to bring supplies and rotate personnel, Skippy reported.
Why?
Because, Chang looked at me, if we could capture one of those supply ships, we could use that to gain access to the station.
Whoa, Skippy exclaimed. Hold your horses there, King Kong. Don't get too excited. That would be a great idea, except that the Advanced Research Directorate doesn't use little civilian cargo ships. The typical ships they use to transfer material and personnel are the equivalent of a light cruiser, and some are bigger than that. The ARD is well aware that the items those ships transport are valuable. Even the Theranin researchers themselves are valuable if captured. ARD does not take any risks that some ambitious Kristang will want to get their hands on advanced Theranin research. To further dissuade you from the idiotic idea of capturing an ARD ship, you would need to do it in a way that leaves the ship undamaged. No way would the asteroid base allow a battle-damaged ship to dock. Also, from the data I do have about these type of high-security ARD facilities, their procedure is probably to have an approaching ship be met at the outer edge of the star system and escorted in by the guard ship. The supply ship would need to rendezvous with the local guard ship, and the security procedure may include the incoming ship being boarded for inspection.
Damn,
Chang frowned.
Scratch that idea.
Colonel, that is a good idea, I assured my executive officer. If we had a way to make it work.
Chang's suggestion had given me the beginning of an idea.
Skippy, why is that research station there?
There was a pause before Skippy answered.
I do not know how to answer that very vague question, Joe. It is there because the Theranin put it there.
Let me be more precise.
Why did the Theranin put it there, specifically?
What is special about that location?
You told us that being near a neutron star provides additional security.
But they could have accomplished the same level of security by doing that research at a big military base.
Okay. All right. That is not an entirely stupid question, Joe. First, they wouldn't want to conduct high-energy research near a military base because there is significant danger of things going boom in a big way. So, they needed a different way to provide security. More importantly, proximity to a neutron star allows research into the effects of intense gravimetric fields and, as Dr. Friedlander observed, the effect of time dilation.
I asked my question more specifically.
Does being close to a neutron star make it easier to figure out how an Elder power tap works?
No, it does not.
Well, maybe.
No. No, it does not.
The Theranin at one time thought being near a neutron star would provide insight into quantum bubbles, but they were mistaken. Because neutron stars rotate so rapidly, their immense mass actually drags space-time around with them, but that doesn't provide any useful insight to bubble energy.
So this asteroid station is not there for the purpose of research and power taps?
No. The Theranin do have a few facilities dedicated to power taps, or quantum bubble, or zero-point energy, or whatever you want to call it. The sad truth is, the reason some power taps are at the neutron star facility is because the Theranin are desperate. They have tried everything to figure out how Elder power taps work, and all their years of intense research has yielded no results.
No, wait.
There was one result, a long time ago. Some idiot Theranin screwed with a power tap, and the result was a 7-megaton explosion that wiped out a major military base and left a crater that is visible from space.
Skippy chuckled.
My laugh was not at the loss of Theranin lives, it was because the power tap didn't cause that explosion. The power tap simply happened to be there. That now-deceased Theranin researcher actually managed to tap into a quantum energy flow for the briefest of moments, and if he had lived, he would be astonished. Sadly, that researcher and all the data were consumed in the massive explosion. The Theranin still think they somehow managed to get a power tap activated but couldn't control it, and that idiotic misconception has caused Theranin research to go down the wrong track ever since.
And my heart bleeds for them, Skippy.
Somehow I suspect you are lying about that, Joe.
You think?
They don't get a whole lot of sympathy from me either, Skippy said with disgust.
Yep.
So research into power taps can happen a lot of places.
Yes, although the ARD only very rarely exchanges research data and materials with the military R&D group.
Too bad for them.
Skippy, those supply ships bring supplies to the station. Do they also bring things away from the station?
As I said that, Major Smythe sucked in a breath as he understood my idea.
Duh, of course they do, Joe.
Great. Then we don't have to go into a Theranin station to get our hands on a power tap, I said with a big grin on my face.
We'll have one delivered to us.
Shit, Skippy grumbled.
Is this one of your ideas? Because if it is, then damn it, this one totally snuck up on me.
Joe, I can assure you the Advanced Research Directorate will not deliver a power tap to you, not even if you have a coupon.
We don't need a coupon. We have a Skippy.
Explain this to me again, Joe, Skippy said while I was back in my office. I'm not clear exactly what you want.
It's easy, Skippy. We need an ARD supply ship to pick up a fixable Elder power tap from a research facility that has one and deliver it to a facility that will be easy for us to attack.
Just like that.
Just like that, yeah.
Is there a problem?
Oh, so, so many problems, Joe.
First, the Advanced Research Directorate does not have a web portal where you can click on the items you want and add them to your shopping cart. I would need to fake a message from ARD headquarters and transmit that message to an ARD ship.
Uh-huh.
So?
We have our own data relay station now, Skippy.
I knew that he was super absent-minded at times, but...
Oh, you think you are so freaking smart, don't you?
Well, smart guy. The problem is that we do not have access to flight schedules for ARD ships.
What?
You told us that a relay station has access to all the information we needed, I protested.
All the information we need in order to determine what the Theranan know about the destruction of their surveyor ship and whether they will be sending another ship to Earth, yes.
Joe, relay stations are run by the Theranan military, so they contain military information.
The ARD will not trust their data passing through a military relay, so they do not use relay stations for sensitive data.
ARD ships only use relay stations to pass highly encrypted messages that do not contain sensitive data.
Well, crap. My shoulders slumped. So we have no way to know whether an ARD ship is going to be visiting an ARD facility that has a power tap you can fix.
There goes my whole idea. Damn, Skippy, I'm sorry for wasting your time. Everyone's time. You're right. I am a dumb monkey. Shit. Now we have to start over, and... ugh. The thought hit me. First, I need to explain to everyone how arrogant and stupid I was.
Joe?
Yeah. As joyously entertaining as it is to watch you beat yourself up, and believe me, I am absolutely tingling all over with delight.
It is not yet necessary.
How do you figure that?
Because, you arrogant, smart-ass peepee-head, I did not say your plan wouldn't work. All I said was that I do not have access to the flight schedules of ARD starships.
Peepee-head. That was a new insult from Skippy. His comment made me pause for a moment. This time it's me who is not following you, Skippy.
ARD's starships are like any other Theranan starships. While they are capable of independent interstellar travel, it's not efficient for them to travel entirely on their own. So they hitch rides on star carriers, which are controlled by the military. I do have access to military flight schedules. That means I am able to see when star carriers are scheduled to make stops at star systems which contain only ARD facilities. Logically, those star carriers must be dropping off and picking up ARD ships. By analyzing the flight schedules of star carriers that are transporting ARD ships, I can derive ARD flight schedules.
You just love yanking my chain, Skippy.
Oh, more than I could ever explain, Joe. However, I didn't do it deliberately this time. Your thought process is such an incredible mess that it is difficult for me to guess what you are thinking.
I couldn't tell whether he was telling the truth or yanking my chain again.
Whatever. Great. So you can predict which ARD ships will be visiting ARD facilities that have fixable power taps and subsequently visiting an ARD facility that is a softer target?
Affirmative, Colonel Joe.
Outstanding.
Let's look at the potential targets, and we will select the best option. Then you can transmit our delivery order from our personal relay station.
Joe?
Yeah.
There is one teensy-weensy problem with that idea. There are no ARD ships scheduled to pass by our relay station within the next 8 months. By that time, our station is scheduled for a crew change, and we will need to blow it up to cover our tracks.
Damn it! This is freaking impossible, Skippy. There are roadblocks everywhere.
Perhaps not. Give me a minute here. Do a crossword puzzle or something. I need to do some Skippy-level number crunching.
I don't have a crossword puzzle.
My tablet had plenty of crosswords on it, but I figured Skippy would be done before I got started on one.
Fine, I'll give you one myself. Three letters, the clue is feline, begins with C and A.
Oh, you are freaking hilarious. Although I was trying to think what the answer could be, because Skippy liked to give me trick questions.
I'm done. The answer is cat, by the way. I believe that I have a solution, Joey. There is a convoluted route I can use to route messages to ARD ships, beginning with our relay station. The catch, before you get all excited, is this incredibly complicated method only results in one possible target for us, in the time available.
Okay. I took a deep breath. You can get an ARD ship to pick up a fixable power tap from a facility that is strongly defended and deliver it to an ARD facility that is a much easier target?
Wow, let me understand this. You're asking if I can use our own personal relay station to send a highly encrypted message that contains all the proper ARD multi-level authentication codes. A message that will be routed through several ships, multiple wormholes, and multiple relay stations until it eventually gets to the one particular ARD ship we want. A ship that I selected because I am able to predict which star carriers are playing host to ARD ships. The message needs to instruct that ARD ship to simply pick up a valuable Elder artifact, no questions asked, and just drop it off at an isolated, weakly defended ARD facility, again with no questions asked.
You're asking if I can do all that, Joe?
since he put it that way, it did sound like a lot of work. Yes? Can you do it?
Oh, sure. No problem.
Easy peasy for me. Come on, Joe. Trust the awesomeness. Great. I wondered whether trust the awesomeness should become the official motto of the Merry Band of Pirates. Joe, the best news is that the target I have in mind has less than a dozen civilian ARD researchers and almost no defensive capability. No neutron star? Nope. No black hole either. Nothing exotic. This is an uninhabited planet. It even has an atmosphere as a bonus. Sounds too easy. What's the catch?
Well, you are very much not going to like this.
Paradise. The sound made General Marcellus awaken immediately. He hadn't been sleeping well for a while, particularly not since giant maser cannons that no one had known anything about obliterated the Kristang battle group that had been looming above their heads. Marcellus had offered General Nivelle his resignation that very day. If the UNEF chief of intelligence had not known the planet they were on had such a powerful defensive capability, then he was not of any use to Nivelle. The French general currently in command of UNEF refused to accept Marcellus's resignation because Nivelle had just ended a phone call with the Ruhar deputy administrator of the planet, and the Ruhar government also had not known about the projectors either. It had been a hurried call, Nivelle said. The deputy administrator was understandably busy with a massive air battle raging above her head. Other than seeing ships exploding in orbit and a few fortunate ships jumping away, the humans on Lemuria did not directly experience the resulting battle. There were some isolated, twisting contrails low on the northern horizon as fighter aircraft tangled, but none of the air action took place over Lemuria. The effect that most humans noticed was the Z-phone network suddenly shutting down with no warning. Without the ability to connect to the global network, communications relied on messages being passed from one phone to the next, using the limited-range backup direct transmission capability of the Z-phones. Someone had attacked the Kristang battlegroup, the message from UNEF HQ stated. We have no additional information. Please remain calm and attend to your duties. The soldiers of UNEF, whether American, Chinese, Indian, British, or French, all knew what remain calm meant. It meant that it was seriously time to panic. For the keepers who had pledged continued loyalty to the Kristang, loyalty that was entirely one-sided, the news generated very understandable panic. Arrival of the Kristang battle group in orbit had made hope soar within the keeper community, even though the Kristang said they considered all humans on the planet to be traitors. Surely, the keepers had told each other, they could demonstrate their loyalty to the Kristang. Some had even gone so far as to damage or sabotage agricultural equipment the Ruhar had loaned to UNEF, although hurting the ability of humans to feed themselves did not make sense to most people, even most of the keeper leaders. Taking apart a tractor was not a gesture the Kristang were likely to notice, and if humans were again to serve as ground troops for their Kristang patrons, they would need human food. Even people who were not keepers felt some dismay at the unexpected destruction of the Kristang battle group. The ending of the ceasefire meant yet more uncertainty, yet more combat in which humans might become direct targets or collateral damage. More importantly to all humans on Paradise was that with the Kristang gone, UNEF's slim hope of a link to Earth was gone with them. Sitting bolt upright in his cot, Marcellus identified the sound that had awakened him. It was an alert from his E-phone.
"Marcellus," he said as he slipped the earpiece in.
"General, we have a situation," reported Captain Chen.
She was one of Marcellus's aides and the current intelligence duty officer.
"An Indian village attacked a French village about 30 minutes ago. There are casualties on both sides, sir."
"God damn it," Marcellus swore as he laced his boots. "Was it keepers?"
UNEF HQ intel had been keeping constant track of the keeper movement in case they became a security threat. The situation was complicated by the fact that keepers had adherents within the officers of UNEF HQ. Many adherents. Marcellus estimated that 15% of the headquarters staff pledged continued loyalty to the Kristang. It was a solid estimate. All he had to do was ask people their opinions. Being a keeper was not against UNEF policy or regulations. He had keepers on his own intel staff. That fact had surprised Marcellus. He thought that people who had access to the best information would be the least interested in aligning with the species that was oppressing Earth.
The human capacity to ignore facts and believe what they wanted to believe was a continued source of amazement and frustration to Marcellus.
"This doesn't appear to be related to the Keeper movement, sir," Chen said stiffly,
and Marcellus remembered that Chen herself had expressed some sympathy with the Keepers.
"This is the Indian village that had most of their crops burned out by a Kristang raid, sir. They've been complaining that HQ wasn't getting supplies to them quickly enough. We explained that we have been sending what we can scrape together. The French are reporting that the Indians targeted their supply of seeds and farming tools first. They also took sacks of grain. The French were pursuing—"
"That's the last thing we need."
"Yes, sir. And we have ordered both the French to return to their village and the Indians to drop the supplies that they—"
She hesitated to use the word stole, since most food stocks technically belong to UNEF rather than individual villages.
"That they took. We need to get a jump on this, sir. The French have one dead and three seriously injured. There is at least one fatality on the Indian side. This news has already spread by Z-phone. We've picked up chatter in French villages calling for retaliation."
"Shit," Marcella said. "I'll inform General Nivelle,"
who would not be happy to hear that his own countrymen had been attacked and killed. Marcellus planned to advise Nivelle that the UNEF commander needed to excuse himself from the investigation of the attack on the French village and from deciding on any subsequent punishment. With Nivelle out, the responsibility would fall to General Tolliver.
"No, damn it," Marcellus thought. "They couldn't have a British officer deciding the fate of Indian troops because of the colonial history between those two countries."
Currently third in the command structure was a Chinese general, and the testy relationship between China and India back on Earth made it unworkable for a Chinese to investigate possible crimes by Indian troops. That left the Americans, and Marcellus himself could not get involved. Damn it all. UNEF was just too complicated and unwieldy an organization. When they had a common mission and a common enemy, differences between nationalities had been able to be suppressed temporarily. Now, UNEF had no mission other than survival, and troops disagreed on whether their enemy were the Ruhar or the Kristang, or both, or neither.
"What do we have in the area?" Marcellus asked.
"One French MP unit for security. They're on their way and should arrive within the hour. They have been ordered to secure the French village and provide medical assistance, but not to pursue the Indians. There is a Chinese security team awaiting orders to move on the Indian village, sir. They know not to move without orders."
"That's one good thing tonight. What the hell were the Indians thinking?"
Although Captain Chen knew that Marcellus had asked a rhetorical question, she answered.
"They are desperate, General. They're hungry. They don't have any hope of ever getting home or even hearing from their families on Earth again."
"That applies to all of us, Captain,"
Marcellus said quietly, including himself. He had a wife and a young daughter back on Earth. He might never see them again. He might never know if they were still alive, and they might never learn of his fate. That was a very hard fact to deal with.